4 months after firing its CEO, Yahoo has a new leader. Scott Thompson comes from eBay, where he ran PayPal, the system people use to pay for purchases online. Now he faces a turnaround job, as NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
The internet giant that pioneered a lot of what's cool on the web has been struggling for a long time. And while Yahoo still has more than 700 million users, its ad revenues are falling while Facebook's and Google's are rising.
I think Yahoo just needs some clear focus to go after, whatever it is.
Sharvan Boskirk is an analyst at Forrester Research. She says leadership and direction have been in short supply at the company.
Yahoo's problem is it can't decide if it's a media company, a market research company, a technology company, or a data company.
And there are personnel problems, too, says analyst Rob Enderle.
Morale is very low. There are a mismatch of employees left over from different initiatives. It's kind of a mess, though it does have a very strong brand. It has one of the strongest brands on the internet.
Incoming CEO Thompson says the company's core assets are stronger than people believe. In addition to the well-known brand, he cites sophisticated technology and access to reams of data. The choice of the New England native surprised many observers. Thompson has no media background, no experience in online advertising, and no experience reviving struggling companies. Again, analyst Sharvan Boskirk.
I always think that people take jobs like this because to turn a company around is a pretty great accomplishment. I don't think it's an impossible situation. What I expect we'll see is some sales. I expect we'll see Yahoo selling off parts of their business.
One of those sales may well be the company's 40% interest in Alibaba. The Chinese search engine giant has been trying to get out from under Yahoo for some time, and many analysts had been advocating a sale long before now. Scott Thompson starts his new job as Yahoo CEO next week. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. On this program, we often talk about the people and ideas that are changing the country and how we are adjusting to those changes. In a few minutes, we will hear from Ibtihaj Muhammad. She is hoping to represent the U.S. in the 2012 Olympics in fencing, but she is also hoping to represent something else there, too, her Muslim faith. We'll find out more in a few minutes. But first, we go to Tucson, Arizona, where the Mexican-American Studies program taught in public schools is in danger. In June 2011, the state superintendent of public instruction, John Hoopenthal, said the program violates a state law banning courses that promote resentment toward another race or class. The school district appealed, and in late December, state administrative law judge Lewis Cowell affirmed Hoopenthal's decision. Now the superintendent has to make a final decision on whether the program violates the law. If he says it does, it could cost the school district millions of dollars. We wanted to learn more about the situation, so we've called upon Stephen Caesar. He has been covering this story for the Los Angeles Times, and he's with us now. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
Well, we should probably just back up a second and say that the state law, in fact, was aimed at this particular program, was it not?
Right. Well, many trace this back to 2006 when well-known activist Dolores Huerta spoke at Tucson High, and in her remarks to students, she said that Republicans hate Latinos. And then, at the then state superintendent of schools, Tom Horn, who's the current attorney general, tried to counter that message by sending his then deputy, who was a Latino Republican, to speak to the students. And while she was speaking, some students stood up, turned their backs, lifted their fists in the air. Some covered their mouths in tapes. Others walked out. And Horn came back and wrote a letter to the citizens of Tucson saying that he believed that the students did not learn this rudeness from home, but rather from their Mexican-American studies teachers. And so he began crafting a law that went into effect January last year. And his successor, Hoopenthal, decided that the classes were indeed in violation of the law.
Well, you can understand how, oftentimes, political leaders don't appreciate the way students behave in public forums. But what about the classes themselves that are actually taught? Can you just give us an example of, or
sure,
are there some specific examples that are cited about what exactly these officials find inappropriate in the curriculum?
Well, Hoopenthal likes to mention an occasion where he sat in on a Chicano literature class, and he mentions on the wall there is an image of Che Guevara, and that a lecturer cast Benjamin Franklin as a racist. And he mentions that while this lecturer did not directly portray Mexican-Americans as an oppressed minority, There's this sort of implied framework that, in his words, Hispanics are the oppressed and Caucasians are the oppressors.
Well, actually, we had a chance to speak with the superintendent yesterday. He wasn't available to join our conversation. But let's just give you a, let's just play a short clip of what he told us. Here it is.
The consistent pattern that we found in the lesson plans was that they characterized historical events in racial terms. Absolutely, we have to study historical injustice, but we need to do that within the context of creating a better society, not creating racial resentment that leads students into an attitude of getting even as opposed to getting ahead.
Does that represent the perspective that you've been hearing from him?
Yeah, definitely.
And I know that you said, though, he has sometimes in the past expressed this in terms that he now regrets, that he has himself used language that he now regrets. That, for example, I understand that he said that at one point he compared this curriculum to, you know, the Hitler Youth being indoctrinated.
Right. And in my interviews with him, he admits that was an inflammatory comment. He doesn't use it anymore, and that it was, when he did use it, it was on a purely academic basis, and that, you know, when these historical events are placed in the context of race, they inflame certain passions.
But what if race is in fact the truth? I mean, what if race is in fact the issue? How does he recommend that these matters be taught? I mean, for example, that, you know, slavery in the United States at one point, well, did become racialized. What is his recommendation about how? I mean, I know that's not the issue in the Mexican American Studies program, but how does he feel that should be addressed?
Well, you know, he hasn't been exactly specific with how this should be taught, so much that it shouldn't be taught in the way that Tucson goes about it. He mentions that these classes, you know, teach these narratives that can, you know, promote this sort of groupthink and victimhood among this group of students.
And what
are
the
What
did the supporters say?
Well, supporters argue that, you know, it does none of that, and that these classes actually push these marginalized Latino students to excel, and that they teach these long-neglected slices of American cultural heritage, you know, Chicano perspectives on literature, history, social justice. They argue that they aren't trying to change the narrative so much that they're trying to be included in it. And on a sort of larger sense, for many Latinos, it's not just about the program. They believe that this law is just sort of another method in which Arizona is attempting to rein in the burgeoning social and political influence of Latinos in the state, along with SB 1070, which was the strict immigration law that passed in 2010.
That is certainly many people are familiar with and has been covered extensively both in the local and the national media. Now, I understand that some students and teachers filed a federal lawsuit saying that the law banning the program is unconstitutional. What are their arguments?
That it infringes on their First Amendment rights, and they argue that they could possibly lose their jobs should the program be dismantled. And so they've asked the federal court to place an injunction on the law, which would, you know, supersede anything at the state level.
What are there any, you know, bystanders here? I'm just sort of wondering if there's a middle. I mean, you've got on the one hand, well, actually, really what I'm also interested in, whether are the Latino parents supportive of the program? Who are also taxpayers in this community? I'm curious about what is public opinion saying about this?
It's mixed, you know, between Latinos and other parents. It's not really clear cut. There's a lot of, you know, white students that are in these classes, and white parents who support it. The community is sort of a very rich history in this community. Tucson's very proud of its place in the Chicano movement of the 60s and 70s, and so it's mixed in the community. It's Tucson's more, you know, it's different than Phoenix. It's more of a liberal area in sort of a red state.
What is your sense of where this goes? Forgive me, Stephen. Where is this, your sense of where this goes next?
Well, you know, the Hoopenthal has a chance, has 30 days from when the judge came back with his ruling to make another final decision. When he does, the district can decide either to, you know, accept the ruling or work the program into compliance or appeal again to Superior Court. And it's not exactly clear what they'll do.
It's a very rich story, and we do hope you'll keep us posted.
Thanks for having me.
Stephen Caesar is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He's been covering the story in Tucson closely. He was kind enough to join us from NPR member station KPCC in Pasadena, California. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have the story of a Midwestern kid who grew up differently than many people around him. In the 1980s, Ayat Akhtar was living in Wisconsin, an American kid born of Pakistani-American parents who were Muslim.
People, at least in the Midwest, where I was growing up, didn't really even know what Muslims were. So, I mean, my friends knew that I was from somewhere, or my parents were from somewhere different, but you weren't really sure what that place was. And, you know, after all, I did like the Green Bay Packers, so it didn't really matter. You know what I mean?
As long as you've got that, you're allowed. You're allowed into Wisconsin.
I'm from Wisconsin.
Ayat Akhtar grew up to be a writer. He is the author of a novel called American Dervish. It explores the difficult subject of Islam in America. It's about a kid named Hyatt growing up in Wisconsin. He's American-born, but his ancestral country and religion catch up with him when his mother's best friend Mina arrives from Pakistan.
She's a charismatic and brilliant, beautiful woman, and so she influences Hyatt in a number of ways. He experiences his first sort of awakenings of the heart and of the body in her presence, and he also is introduced to Islam, which is something that his parents don't have much interest in, and he really takes to that.
And this is really fascinating to me, that you have this woman who the boy meets, who is religious but in a very progressive and open way, and talks about reinterpreting the faith for modern times, something that more conservative Muslims would reject. The boy is under her influence, and yet he becomes, for a time anyway, a very conservative young Muslim.
Well, he does, because he begins to feel that there is some certainty that he can latch onto by reading the book, the Quran, in a literal way. And the sort of central emotional through line of the book has to do with his burgeoning jealousy when Mina falls in love with a Jewish man, and he feels that he's losing his love object.
This could have been a much simpler story, because you have this boy who's Muslim, who's in the United States, who is inspired by Islam and at least for a time becomes a very conservative, purist kind of Muslim. I mean, mm-hmm. He could have been inspired by a radical blind cleric to that approach and mm-hmm. become some kind of wild-eyed radical. You chose to make things far more nuanced all the way through.
I think that's true to life. I've seen a lot of things, growing up in this country as a young Muslim, and I haven't seen that particular, embodiment, what you were describing, because even the sorts of things that I may have seen which coincide with what you're talking about with your example, even those are more nuanced. I think it's always a more complicated picture.
Is it fair to say that Islam doesn't come off terribly well in this book?
It's a question that I've gotten from time to time, but I also get the other side, which is that people say, wow, I read your book and I can't believe how beautiful Islam is. So I think, as with all of the characters in the book, I try to embody them with all of the complexity and the strengths and the flaws that they have. And I think that I'm trying to do the same thing when it comes to representing the practice of the faith.
Well, let me mention just a couple of things that I think a lot of Americans would find alarming. One of the characters, this older woman, Mina, when she's in Pakistan, is divorced by her husband just after giving birth to a baby, simply by having the husband send a note that says 3 times, I divorce you, which is mm-hmm. all you're supposed to have to do under Islam. You have that. You have prejudice against Jews, open prejudice against Jews, jokes being told about Jews and so forth all the way through the book.
Well, I think the jokes are often told by a Jewish character. So, I mean, it's you can dig a little deeper, Steve. I think there's darker stuff than that in the book. There is at the centerpiece of the book, there is a sermon in the mosque that begins with sort of cryptic allusions to verses in the Quran that talk about Jews, and then it becomes an outright anti-Semitic sermon. So, I think that the book has a very, how do I put it? It would be impossible to read, for example, the Old Testament and not to remark or to have some awareness of the fact that the characters in the stories in the Old Testament are profoundly flawed. And I think that I'm bringing the same perspective to the Quran, which is to say that there are extraordinary things, things of extraordinary beauty and wisdom in the Quran, and then there are also there's also stuff that is darker. And that's true, again, to the human psyche. These are books which the Quran, the Old Testament, the Gospels, they're books that embody the fullness of the human experience. And for anyone to suggest that they don't have that darker side, which we ourselves have, I think is, again, only part of the picture.
Eyad Akhtar is the author of American Dervish. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Next time you buy potato chips, take a look at the list of ingredients. There's a good chance that right after potatoes, you'll see sunflower oil. But before the state flower of Kansas became the favorite oil of the potato chip industry, it had to take a long detour through the Soviet Union. NPR's Dan Charles is here to tell the tale.
It's a curious fact. Very few of the crops that we grow for food actually came originally from North America.
We have cranberries, pecans, some of the blueberries, and then sunflower.
Gerald Seiler works at the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Sunflower Research Unit in Fargo, North Dakota.
Now, I always call the sunflower one of our native sons because, you know, we are the center of origin of this crop.
Before Columbus ever arrived here, Native Americans selected from among the dozens of wild sunflowers that grew here and created tall plants with a single large head and seeds you can eat. After that, though, the sunflower found itself neglected. This native son had to go abroad to find love and respect. Early Spanish explorers took it home with them. It spread across Europe. Van Gogh painted its portrait. And finally, it was the Russians who adopted it. They turned this Native American plant into one of the world's great sources of cooking oil. Why Russia? Jerry Miller, who was a sunflower breeder at the Fargo Research Center until he retired a few years ago, says it was partly religion. The Russian Orthodox Church had a list of foods you weren't supposed to eat during Lent that included butter and lard.
But it just happened that sunflower was such a new crop that it was not on the prohibited list. And so when they discovered that they could use sunflower, it blossomed.
In the 1800s, sunflowers covered huge fields in Russia and Ukraine. And then under Stalin, Soviet plant breeders made these little oil factories even more productive. They created varieties with more oil in their seeds, almost 50% more. Sunflower oil filled grocery shelves across Europe. Brent Holke, who's now the USDA sunflower breeder in Fargo, says this oil tastes great.
In Europe, if you run across a oil snob, they'll tell you which ones are the best olive oils, and then secondly, they'll tell you which ones are the best sunflower oils.
But in the U.S., sunflower oil couldn't compete with corn and soybean oil, which are cheaper. Then came the 1990s, and sunflowers got a boost from somewhere they never expected, potato chip makers.
This all started with what was called the Mediterranean diet.
Jerry Miller says olive oil was in, trans fats were on their way out, and companies like Frito-Lay were asking, if people don't want to eat trans fat-filled, partially hydrogenated soybean oil, how are we going to fry our potato chips? Jerry Miller had an answer. The Russians, he told them, had created a mutant sunflower, one that produced oil that was still good for you and didn't go bad while frying potato chips. So no trans fats.
Frito-Lay had a chemist by the name of Manoj Gupta who recognized immediately what it could do for his company. And he said, let's go. Let's do this.
Today, farmers in the U.S. produce only this new kind of sunflower oil, and the potato chip industry can't get enough of it. For an encore, the sunflower may be going where no oil seed has gone before. Right now, in the greenhouses of the USDA's Sunflower Research Center in Fargo, Brent Holke is growing sunflowers with yet another genetic trait. These plants may eventually produce oil that's lower in saturated fat than any other vegetable oil. The genes for these low levels of saturated fat, they came from sunflowers that were collected in Hungary and Egypt.
It's just so fascinating that something like that could exist on the landscape and you just don't even know it.
Which brings us back to the USDA's Gerald Seiler, the man who calls the sunflower America's native son. He's pretty sure there are more genetic treasures like this still out there, in cultivated sunflowers all over the world, and in the whole extended family of sunflowers growing wild from Texas to Canada. For the past 40 years, he's been driving country roads, stopping to gather sunflower seeds. And he deposits the seeds in storage vaults like this one at his research center in Fargo.
And basically, it's a big refrigerator, big cold room.
He shows me row after row of metal and plastic boxes. Each one holds hundreds of seed samples. And I notice a lot of these boxes have the name Seiler on them.
This is my life here. This is 30-some years of work in here.
Each seed is a package of genes that Seiler wants to preserve. Because those genes, Seiler says, they're like nuggets of gold. Their true value
is still waiting to be discovered. Dan Charles, NPR News.
The idea that pumping water into wells could be causing small earthquakes has taken many people by surprise. Gas industry executives say there is no hard evidence that their activities are causing these quakes, but some scientists say it's certainly possible. In fact, people have been causing earthquakes for years. We're joined by NPR science correspondent Christopher Joyce. Chris, welcome.
Glad to be here, Linda.
So what is the evidence that human activity can cause earthquakes? What sort of thing could do it?
Mining, for one thing. This is one of the first places they got this notion. It was in South Africa, actually, in the 60s, and it was gold mines. And what happened at the, you create a void underground, and then sometimes it collapses, and you've created an earthquake. But there's another way that mines alter what goes on underground. You pump water out of mines because you can't work in a mine when it floods. And when you move water around underground, you know, you're messing with a very complicated array of stresses along fault lines underground.
Now, hydrofracking operators do pump a lot of water underground.
They do. When they frack, as it's called, and they break the rock with the water, they use a lot of water. But that's not really what these earthquakes are all about. These quakes in Ohio and Arkansas are associated with wastewater wells. What happens is you use the water to frack for a day or two, and then you retrieve it, and then you haul it off and you pump it into these wastewater wells. And this is a lot of water, and it's quite deep. And so the deeper you go with, the more water, the more pressure you create underground. And that builds up. And if you get it near a fault line, it can trigger a quake. And actually, this happened in the 1960s in the Rocky Flats Arsenal in Colorado. There was a wastewater well, and they pumped a lot of water down there, and they got a 4.8 magnitude quake.
So what exactly does the water do to the fault?
Well, if you want to try to visualize a fault, let's say you put your hands together like you're praying, okay? You open up with your fingers extended, and then that line between your hands is the fault. So press your hands together hard, and that's called clamping pressure. It's keeping that fault stable. You add water, like a lubricant, inside that fault line, and boom, it slips and slides, and you got a quake.
So people have been moving water around underground. They've been doing it for a long time, from mining to get rid of wastewater. Why haven't people associated that activity with quakes before?
Well, geologists have, a few geologists. It's not an area that people paid that much attention to. The geological conditions have to be just right. The quakes generally are very small, and it's hard to tell what's causing them. It could be natural, or it could be other human activities.
But Chris, now these fracking wells are proliferating in places that are densely populated, places like Pennsylvania and Ohio, places where we haven't seen this thing before. So are we going to see more earthquakes?
That's definitely a possibility. What's happened is that you're doing this in places that are geologically different. It's not very active, but there are faults there. They're near heavily populated areas, so people are going to be paying attention.
So is it possible to avoid creating quakes?
Well, that's one of the things that the U.S. Geological Survey is working on right now. They're saying, look, if you do a seismic survey before you create a wastewater well, you can avoid possibly the worst areas. You can look for faults and stay away from them. You can look for the kind of rock that's more permeable, that's not so brittle, sandstone, for example. It absorbs the water like a sponge instead of letting the pressure build up.
Presumably, it's not cheap. Can you do these preventative things in a sensible way that will still make the fracking a reasonable thing to do?
I'm not in the gas business, but I don't know their bottom line, but it's certainly not out of the question to do seismic surveys. People do them all the time for other underground, for mining, obviously, and for doing oil exploration. It just is something that's not required at the moment and probably might well be required in the future. But either that or recycle the water and clean it up, but that's also an expensive process.
Chris, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
NPR's science correspondent, Christopher Joyce.